What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Misha Galperin, the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for Israel, one of the most important non-governmental Jewish organizations in the world. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. One of the consequences of being in a readjustment mode after my sabbatical trip around the world is that I continue to try to assimilate all that I learned on that extraordinary journey over the course of 3 very active months. I visited many countries and experienced profound religious intensity in many amazing places. There was deep commitment almost everywhere I went, religious commitment, and a great respect for the sanctity of ritual and the intrinsic value of worship community. No matter which religion it was that sanctified the holy places I was visiting, there was something powerful and meaningful in the energy they possessed and the dedication of the devotees. But a conversation I had at one of the final places I went to surprised me. I had just finished hiking and touring at Machu Picchu in Peru, a truly magnificent place. It was Easter Sunday, or the second day of Pesach if you prefer, and I was looking for an unoccupied bench to rest my tired legs as I waited for a train. I asked a couple if they would mind if I joined them on a long bench they were on, and they invited me to sit. We struck up a conversation. It turned out that the man was from Santa Cruz, California, while the woman was from Oxford, England. We chatted for a bit, and they asked me what I was doing there. I told them I was writing a book on the holiest places on earth and had visited over 100 of them by that point. And the man said, "Religious places? But nobody does religion anymore." I thought, well, maybe they don't in Santa Cruz, California, but they sure do in almost every place I've visited all around the globe on every inhabited continent on Earth. And now a recent study has confirmed that. A Gallup poll that came out last week took the religious pulse of 65 countries around the world. Its conclusions are revealing. Jean-Marc Leger, president of Gallup, said, "Religion continues to dominate our everyday lives, and we see that the total number of people who consider themselves to be religious is actually relatively high. With the trend of an increasingly religious youth globally, we can assume that the number of people who consider themselves religious will only continue to increase." Overall, the study found, young people tend to be the most religious. 66% of the people under 34 years old around the world are religious, compared with 60% of the people 35 years old or older. In addition, the rich, it found, are the least religious people on Earth. While only 6% of people with low income describe themselves as convinced atheists worldwide, 25% of those with high income say they don't believe in God. In the Middle East and North Africa, 82% of people consider themselves religious. 82%. But Thailand, it turns out, is the most religious country in the world, according to Gallup. 94% of Thais say they are religious. Overall, around the globe, about 63% of people polled say they are religious, far more than half. Interestingly, in Israel, that global proportion is reversed. 65% of the people say they are not religious or that they are convinced atheists. Just 30% say they are. That's very much in keeping with most of the findings in industrialized Western countries. However, in the West Bank and Gaza, the population is much closer to the regional average of the Middle East. 75% of people say they're religious. Only 18% say they are not. The least religious country in the world today is China. 61% of the people say they are convinced atheists, about twice as many as any other country on the globe. In the West, Sweden is the least religious country. Nearly 80% say they are either not religious or maybe, in fact, convinced atheists. You know, it's an interesting and not entirely predictable set of results. I've been in Thailand. It didn't seem that religious, but boy, they do have a lot of temples. But anyway, it certainly demonstrates that religion is not disappearing anytime soon, that the vast majority of the human race considers religion to be essential to normal, civilized life. It's also fascinating that so many young people consider themselves religious, and that the religious population of the world is growing, not shrinking. You know, we're not sure whether the Jewish population of the world is growing or shrinking. But if we Jews could only increase our market share of this growing religious pie, we would really be on the road to success after only 3,800 years of trying. To play us in this morning, maybe kind of on that theme, here's a classic piece of shtick sung by the inimitable Lou Jacoby. The whole world is Jewish when you're in love.
When you're in love, the whole world is Jewish. When you're in love, rabbits will turn to mink. You seem to fly, you wink and feel so chipper. The moon is a yarmulke high in the sky, and each day is Yom Kippur.
When you're in love,
each deal is a big deal. Never again will men call you a schlemiel. Yes, when you start to fall, the world is your own matzo ball. And everything's borrowed and blue, old and newish. Sort of glass of tea for two-ish. Cause the whole world is Jewish when you're in love. You just take your picture. Mama won't mind to find you brought home a Schicksal. You're on the loop, Niagara will spill chicken soup.
Everything's borrowed, blue, old, and newish.
Lovely, lovely.
Sort of glass of tea for two.
It's a Machiah. But the whole world is Jewish when you're in love.
That was the song When You're in Love, the Whole World is Jewish from the classic Jewish comedy album of the same name. The State of Israel has long understood that it has a unique responsibility to rescue Jews whenever they are endangered, anywhere in the world. Misha Galperin is the CEO and president of the organization that has, among many other responsibilities, the greatest responsibility for this sacred task. It's called the Jewish Agency. Meet Misha when we return here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that Palmer's
enterprise of the Pasquagaki tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Misha Galperin, is the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for Israel, known as the Jewish Agency, or sometimes JAFI, a kind of quasi-governmental organization that was founded in 1929, almost 20 years before Israel achieved statehood, and it was instrumental in the founding of the state. It has continued to serve as an important connection between Israel and Jewish communities all around the world. Misha Galperin is the co-author of The Case for Jewish Peoplehood, Can We Be One? And Reimagining Leadership in Jewish Organizations, 10 Practical Lessons to Help You Implement Change and Achieve Your Goals. He immigrated from the Soviet Union as a teenager, has a PhD in clinical psychology, and has worked in communal service for more than 30 years, and is near the top, almost always, of the Forward 50 Most Influential Jewish Leaders. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So how does a PhD in psychology end up heading the Jewish Agency?
Well, after a few years working in the Jewish community, it's hard for me to understand how anybody without a PhD in clinical psychology can do this sort of work. The truth of the matter is that I didn't intend to go into this kind of work. I was in clinical practice, and I was doing consulting work for Jewish organizations and some pro bono work. And what happened is that I got nominated to participate in a program for lay leadership Jewish literacy development called the Wexner Heritage Project in New York, which I'm sure know about.
I do.
I had nothing short of a transformative experience in the very first class that I attended, where the Jewish imperative of redeeming the captives,
Pidyon Shvuyim, of course,
was discussed as the highest religious duty a Jew can have. And we read a text by Rambam, by Moses Maimonides, arguing why that's the case. And now, at the time, I was doing some consulting work for the Refugee Resettlement Agency in New York called NIANA, New York Association for New Americans, which was founded in 1948, first to help deal with the people coming out of DP camps in Europe, and eventually resettled close to 400,000 Jews and people from Tibet and Afghanistan and Hmong refugees and Ethiopians and others. It was an organization that was redeeming the captives, and I was one of those redeemed. I had no concept that something that was being done
on a global level
Had its origin in something that in 12th century, you know, a Jewish philosopher actually wrote about and talked about, and that connection between a Jewish value and how it gets implemented in action blew me away, and I decided this was something I was going to do for a living.
Fascinating. We will talk much more about the Jewish Agency and your interesting path there and its current path when we come back in a few moments with Misha Galperin here on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Ashrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Ashrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Very challenging week with the huge earthquake in Nepal. And Nepal has a connection for Israelis who go there to trek very frequently when they go around the world after they finish their service in the IDF. One of the first countries that responded immediately with medical aid, with rescue aid, with large airplanes of supplies, with helicopters, was Israel. Talk about how Israelis and how you think about that process.
Yeah, first of all, Nepal is, as you said, is the favorite place for Israeli after they're finishing their 3, 4, 5 years of service at the IDF. They want to, you know, go east and discover the world. So, but it's really, Israel was, I think, if not the first, the second, I think they were the first who arrived there. They even had a hard time to land because they're still aftershocks.
There were still aftershocks in Kathmandu and the airport.
And United States sent like, I think, 56 or 59. Team was about 56 or 59 people. And Israel sent 260. You know, the tiny little Israel, like half size of our Israel.
7.5 million people. America has 330, 350 million people. And Israel sent more.
Yeah. So, but they always do. And, you know, Haaretz just, I think Haaretz just said today that Israel sent all these, you know, huge crew because we have
a lot of experience.
2,000, yeah, and 2,000 Israelis. But the fact that also when it was in Tahiti, last year, 2 years ago, so Israel sent like a huge...
Yeah, in Haiti, there was a huge set of Israeli doctors that went, and that's nowhere near, and there were no Israelis there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and this team includes like heads of like very big hospitals in Israel, like and there were being asked like 5 minutes, you need to be at the airport, like it's really like that, you need to be ready and go. But the Israeli system is organized so, you know, the number two and number three are ready to run the whole hospital as soon as we're really ready to, you know, go and save the world.
It's fascinating. So that commitment, does anybody in Israel ask how much it costs? I mean, in Israel, you know, there's a budget. It's always a challenge. Does anybody say it's very expensive to send 200 Israelis plus all this equipment and rescue equipment? Does anybody question that?
I think the government of Israel have an unrestricted budget line called Tikkun Olam.
To heal the world.
Tikkun Olam, yeah.
That's fantastic. You know, every government should have a budget line, Tikkun Olam, to heal the world.
Yeah, unrestricted.
Unrestricted. You can spend anything you need to save the world from a disaster. It's really a fantastic story. And I would say, unfortunately, Israel's had a lot of experience with crisis. And so the people they send know what they're doing. They're very efficient and very effective.
And I like the fact that the solidarity is not only among Israel or among Jewish
people. It's for the whole human race.
We're really out of solidarity.
I wish them success, and I hope that they're able to ameliorate some of the terrible suffering that's going on in Nepal right now. I'm sure they will.
Amen.
Thank you, Ashrat.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Frida had just finished her fish dinner at the kosher restaurant, and she was not at all happy with it. She called over the waiter. "Listen, waiter," Frida said, "let me tell you, I've tasted fresher fish." And the waiter replied, "Not in here, you haven't." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bahar from the book of Leviticus, which establishes the rules for the sabbatical in Jubilee years, the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. This is a particularly notable portion this year, which is actually the Shemitah, the anniversary of the sabbatical year itself. For perhaps the first time, Jewish communities around the world have become really aware and focused on commemorating this important ancient legislation in contemporary ways. Many of us have been celebrating the Shemitah year with special services, classes, and remembrances in our own congregations. But concern for the environment in Judaism has always been an important part of our tradition. The very first text on caring for the natural world goes back to Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. It all starts with creation, when God placed us in the Garden of Eden and gave us the responsibility to tend to this garden. The most important Jewish legislation in the Torah, however, is found in Leviticus, in the section we read this week in Parshat Behar. You shall have a sabbatical every seventh year, and the land shall rest. We're instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow the fields to lie fallow, to give the earth a chance to rest. This is considered today to be a good, practical agricultural policy everywhere on the earth. It allows time for nature to restore the nutrients that grains leach from the soil. It allows the fallen fruit in the orchards to nourish the loam. And it is a fundamental part of crop rotation in all areas that practice modern farming techniques. The remarkable fact about this Shemitah, this sabbatical mitzvah from God, is that it originated in the Torah, a document that's at least 2,500 years old and which contains text that's quite probably 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism, and the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible human beings is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we're prohibited from destroying our enemy's fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land to feed its inhabitants. This is in sharp contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy of sowing salt in the fields of conquered enemies to destroy them and to create forced starvation going forward, too. Ironically, this Jewish stewardship of the land is also in contrast to the occasional policy of the Israeli military to bulldoze the olive trees of Arab terrorists' families. The injunction is clear. We are supposed to respect the natural environment, since it is a reflection of God's holiness projected into our world. It is also a not-so-subtle hint that we need to seek other kinds of renewable sources of energy, for example, solar power, geothermal, wind power, that do not do permanent damage to the world that God has given us. There are other contemporary consequences for this most ancient commandment. The sabbatical year off of teaching, so beloved on university campuses, and by me as a congregational rabbi, comes directly from this week's portion of Bahar. It's a time to recharge your batteries and renew your scholarship, just as the land replenishes itself through a year of Shemitah, divine rest. A great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation. A reminder that even renewable resources need to be tended. May we learn Bahar's lesson and allow our land to renew itself. And then we might even learn to allow ourselves to be renewed through rest, come to replenish our own spiritual resources, like this week, perhaps, by coming to Shabbat. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Misha Galperin, the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency, will explore what the responsibility to rescue endangered Jews all around the world means and how it is accomplished. Hear about that and the many other aspects of the work of the Jewish Agency when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquigalki Tribe.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The devastating earthquake in Nepal last week killed thousands. The death toll will eventually be more than 10,000, and it is a humanitarian disaster of global proportion. I've been asked often if I was in Nepal during my recent visit to the holiest places on earth. The simple answer is no. I was in northern India, in Bodh Gaya and Varanasi in Delhi, all about 200 miles from the Nepal border, and I met there many Nepalese who live and work in India and send their earnings back to help their impoverished families at home. This is a horrible tragedy, made much worse by the lack of building standards, the bad roads, and the chronically ineffectual government of Nepal. We pray for the victims and encourage donations to all the charities seeking to help alleviate this terrible situation. It should be noted that Israel, as is usual in such natural disasters, was among the first countries to offer assistance to Nepal. 2 days after the earthquake, 2 days while aftershocks were still shaking the country, 4 IDF planes landed in Kathmandu, bringing major quantities of medical supplies and rescue personnel. 3 more came the next day, bringing 50 tons of rescue equipment. It is typical of the Jewish response to tragedy and the Israeli commitment to assisting everyone in the world in distress with their expertise and material that this effort came to Nepal. There are also a number of strange permutations on the Israeli take on this story, and while Nepal may not seem to be on the map of important Jewish places, it has an idiosyncratic but very strong connection to Israel. If you know anything about Israelis, you are probably aware of the fact that nearly all of them, young men, young women both, embark on a long international backpacking trip shortly after completing their army service at the age of 21 or 22 or 23. One of the favored destinations for Israeli backpackers is Nepal for its incredible mountain scenery, Mount Everest among them, and extraordinary monasteries and temples, as well as the inexpensive accommodations, food, and transport in the country. At the time we are recording this, a few Israelis are still possibly missing in Nepal, while over 400 have been airlifted back to Israel. An additional group, perhaps fewer than 100 Israelis now, are still awaiting transport back to Israel on the returning flights from ferrying over the rescue equipment and personnel. While most of the rescued Israelis are trekkers and other tourists, among those who were airlifted back were a number of gay couples who had gone to Nepal to have babies with surrogate Nepalese mothers, and 26 infants were actually evacuated back to Israel. This is a unique situation that requires explanation. For a variety of legal and religious reasons, currently only heterosexual couples can easily employ surrogate mothers in Israel. Gay couples and single parents look abroad to bear children with surrogates. And for many years, India, where costs are low but the standard of medical care is fairly high, India was the preferred surrogacy option for Israelis. But a change in Indian law in 2013 prevented gay men and couples who had been married for less than 2 years from hiring surrogate mothers. This law caught many Israelis midway through the process, and the Indian women who had been engaged as surrogates typically traveled to Nepal to give birth, as Israeli surrogacy agencies relocated from India to Nepal in early 2014. Many Asian and European countries ban commercial surrogacy, and it can cost up to $150,000 for a surrogate in the U.S. or Canada, but it's only about $30,000 in Nepal. While the Israeli government scrambled to evacuate the 26 Israeli newborns and their Israeli parents from Nepal, another 100 women, some Nepalese, some Indian, are still carrying babies for Israelis. Israeli Attorney General Yehuda Weinstein said he would allow the most heavily pregnant to be flown to Israel to give birth. And the outgoing Interior Minister, Gilad Erdan, promised to remove immigration hurdles for the remainder. "We have decided to hold off on all the procedures, even if it causes a problem with the Nepalese or Indian governments, so as to bring over the babies as soon as possible," Erdan said. "This is an unprecedented situation, I think, in human history. It will be fascinating to continue to follow the debate on surrogacy that will come after the worst impact of this devastating earthquake has been ameliorated." In other news from the Holy Land, last Sunday, the Druze community of Israel celebrated the Nebi Shu'eib holiday at the Nebi Shu'eib Shrine in the Galilee, which I visited on my world tour back in February. This time, the ceremony was a little different. In addition to honoring the great Druze prophet Jethro, Moses' father-in-law and Zipporah's father, it also paid tribute to scuba divers, 5 of them, who found the largest gold coin hoard ever discovered in Israel. The cache was found by Israeli divers in the Mediterranean in the ancient harbor at Caesarea National Park in February. They reported their findings to the Dive Club, which called in the Antiquities Authority. Its marine experts hauled out 2,580 gold coins weighing more than 13 pounds from the seabed. The image imprinted on most of the coins is that of Al-Hakim bin Amr Allah, a leading figure in Druze history and tradition. Shortly after the stash was discovered, Druze community leader Sheikh Muwaffaq Tarif contacted the Antiquities Authority Director Israel Hassan and told him how important Al-Hakim was to the Druze community. Al-Hakim was proclaimed the incarnation of God by the Druze community's founder, Ad-Darazi, in the year 1018. His mysterious disappearance while hiking near Cairo in 1021 has enhanced his importance to the Druze, according to whom he is not dead and will return one day as a harbinger of the end of days. The excitement is profound, said Hassan. It's similar to finding a coin with Moses on it. The Israeli divers received awards and certificates for contributing to archaeological research and for their outstanding Israeli citizenship. And finally, two Bar Bat Mitzvah stories, neither very happy, that demonstrate that Al-Hakim may be coming soon because the apocalypse must be on its way, or at least we can see it from here. First, in Rehovot, Israel, a planned group of Bar and Bat Mitzvahs for disabled children was canceled by the ultra-Orthodox mayor. It had been scheduled to take place at the city's conservative Masorati synagogue. Mayor Rachamim Malul, a Knesset member for Shas, the religious Sephardic party, instructed the principal of Lotem, a school for the disabled in Rehovot, to move the ceremony to an Orthodox synagogue and insisted that girls would then not be able to wear talluses or be called up to the Torah. The children had been preparing for these bar and bat mitzvahs for the past several months at the Adaraba Center for Children and Youth with Disabilities, an institution run by the Masorati, the conservative movement in Israel. Last year's B'nai Mitzvah ceremony came off beautifully in the conservative synagogue in Rehovot. Yizhar Hess, a good friend, our first maven on Israel here on Two Jewish nearly 13 years ago, is now the head of the Masorati movement in Israel. He said last week, "The mayor is using children as pawns in a game and holding them hostage in his own political playing field. He is forcing his personal religious views on these children, and by doing so degrades his city and the Jewish religion." He does. In contrast to Orthodox Judaism, the conservative movement, like the Reform movement, considers children with disabilities to be eligible to serve as part of a minyan to read from the Torah once they reach Bar Bat Mitzvah age. Thousands of children in Israel are already celebrating their bar and bat mitzvahs through our program, but it is not children that interest the mayor, Yizhar said. How very sad and how utterly infuriating. Hess noted that the mayors of Be'er Sheva, Ra'anana, and Kfar Saba have routinely attended the bar and bat mitzvah ceremonies for children with disabilities sponsored by the conservative movement. They feel proud that in their city such an important project exists, he said, but not in Rehovot. And this week's sign that the end of the world is in sight comes from a bar mitzvah party in New York. Matt Muirstein's father is Andrew Muirstein, the multimillionaire founder and president of Medallion Financial Corporation. The elder Muirstein hired rapper Nicki Minaj to play his kids' bar mitzvah party at the Pierre Hotel. Minaj is known for her physique and her often X-rated lyrics, but she apparently performed a clean 7-song set and took photos with all the guests. Nobody knows how much she received for playing young Matt's bar mitzvah party, but it likely would have funded several plane loads of emergency relief for the Nepal earthquake victims. What do we make of the fact that the Torah portion for the young man included the holiness code, urging us and his family to take care of the poor and the stranger, the widow and the orphan? Maybe they took it to mean you take care of the local rappers. Sheesh. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Misha Galperin is the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for Israel, JAFI. It was founded 19 years before statehood was achieved by Israel, was instrumental in founding and building the State of Israel. It has continued to serve as the connection between the Jewish state and Jewish communities in many ways everywhere around the world. And perhaps its greatest service, which we spoke about earlier in the program, is saving Jews who are in endangered communities. Misha, you know, I was just in Israel. There's now a very large French contingent in Netanya and elsewhere. There's a lot of talk about the close to 500,000 Jews of France may suddenly be pouring into Israel, depending on how things go in Europe. It's been Argentinian Jews. It's been Jews from many, now Jews from Ukraine, who are trying to get out of the middle of a civil war. Mm-hmm. Are there particular flashpoint areas that our listeners may not be aware of in which the Jewish Agency is involved in trying to save Jews from dangerous situations?
Well, before the crisis in Ukraine and the situation in France and elsewhere in Europe became so heated over the last year, our assessment was that there were about 70,000 Jews in places around the world that are in danger. In danger either of their lives or their property or ability to continue to practice Judaism. Some of those places are fairly obvious. There are 20,000 Jews living in Iran today. There are nearly 20,000 Jews in Turkey. There are remnants of Jewish communities all over the Middle East and some places in Central and South America, which are problematic. Now, it is not to say that there are concerns at the moment that require rescue. And certainly in many places, there are Jews who are choosing not to leave. But those are some of the places I can tell you that over the last couple of years, we've gotten most of the remnants of the Yemenite Jewish community out. There's still some remaining. And
Yemen is a mess right now, of course.
Indeed. And, you know, there's still a few Jews left there. We have the capacity to bring them out the moment they choose to. But Jews have an unfortunate history of waiting until sometimes it's too late. Many of them are, you know, both loyal to the places where they were born and brought up and feel it difficult to move out, even when situation is so difficult. But I wanted to actually go back to your introduction a little bit because...
Please.
The thing that I've discovered when I went to work for the Jewish Agency, which I was only vaguely aware of beforehand, is that the Jewish Agency actually was created in order to build the State of Israel.
Right, right.
It was, in fact, the vehicle that the World Zionist Organization created because of the Balfour Declaration and others, because there needed to be an instrument of creating the state.
The mechanisms that would eventually become...
Right, and so for the first 20 years of its existence, it was doing the things that were necessary to create the state. It was buying out land and organizing the Haganah and smuggling in arms and people. And in fact, when David Ben-Gurion became its second chairman, he turned it into a government in waiting. And in 1948, the state was announced. The first meeting of the Knesset was in what is now the building of the Jewish Agency, a building of the national institutions. Weizmann was sworn in as the president there. And Ben-Gurion became the prime minister, having moved from his position as chairman of the executive, the position that today is occupied by Natan Sharansky,
of course.
The reason the Jewish Agency became so engaged in the immigration and resettlement in Aliyah and Klita is because in 1948, the decision was made that it needs to continue to exist, even though, you know, it now became the government of Israel. But the government and the Jewish communities around the world wanted to preserve a non-governmental mechanism that would, in fact, serve as the link between the Jewish communities of the world and the state of Israel. And the first two tasks that were set for it was the ingathering of exiles, so bringing in 3 million Jews over the next 60 years, and building the state up physically. I didn't know, and I bet most of your listeners don't know, that the Jewish Agency created El Al Airlines and the waterworks and built 900 towns and communities.
Just don't tell Israel. Me they started Bezek. That's the one thing I don't want to hear.
No, I won't, because I don't think they have. But then again, there are things that I don't that I don't know. But you know, the ports and the colleges and the kindergartens and
so
all,
much
all
of the infrastructure was
indeed
created by the Jewish Agency. Sure.
And the gradually, much of that was transferred either to the state or privatized when it was possible to do it. And when Sharansky came to be the chair of the Jewish Agency 6 years ago and then asked me to join him, it was because he and others felt that the greatest a challenge that the Jewish people face that needs to be dealt with by a combination of the Jewish state and Jewish communities is the very issue of the connection between
Israel and the diaspora.
Israel and Jews around the world and connection to each other. Because one thing that people often forget is that Israel is not only the name of the country and the state, it's also the name of our people. And we once were people without a state. Some believe that we're in danger of having a strong state without a people.
I wanted to ask a funny question. I was recently at Pesach Seder in Cuzco, Peru, and I went.
Just
to,
happened to be.
Just happened, you know. This time I wasn't. Didn't happen to be. Didn't have to be at shul, so I went to Cuzco.
You and 700 Israelis.
1,000 actually. Okay. Two shifts of 500.
There we go.
Israeli backpackers traveling the world mm-hmm. after army. There were some older people like me, you know, old, mm-hmm. and then everybody else was 23 or so, just finished the army, haven't gone to college yet, or 22 maybe, mm-hmm. you know, anywhere in that range. Wonderful kids. I guess they're not really kids, but that's what they seem like to me. Very energetic, extraordinary kind of sense of Jewish identity, unrelated really to any of the Jewish communities they're traveling around through.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that it has a whole lot to do with the Jewish Agency, but that's sort of the way that Israelis experience the world for the first time, most of them. And then they come back to Israel and but they don't necessarily connect or understand anything about the Jewish communities they've passed through, and the Jewish communities don't really understand them. I don't know if this is a subject for the Jewish Agency.
It is.
Perhaps you can address
it. It definitely is a subject because it's sort of the mirror image of the problem that young Jews have in the diaspora. In as much as many young Jews in the diaspora are not connected and not aware of Israel as their home, as their state, as something that is there for them as well as for the people who live in Israel. In that very similar way, young Jews in Israel don't often know, understand, or connect to the concept of Jewish people outside of Israel. In fact, it's one of the things that I've been writing about and talking about.
Is I mean,
that
I enjoyed
danger.
Talking to them, but their concept of what I represented or a community
well, and,
was,
and it's, you know,
was
it's,
very
it's,
alien.
It's very interesting. You know, one of the things that made a difference or began to make a difference for young Jews in countries around the world was this notion of a trip to Israel, Birthright, and the program that the Jewish Agency now does called Masa Israel Journey, where we bring young people in for 5 months to a year for an intensive program, or Onward Israel, which is a 6 to 10 week internship. And one reason that this works, we believe, to heighten the identity is because it's an intensive experience of actually being in the community. It's similar to going to a Jewish overnight camp. It's an experience of
24
living,
hours
breathing,
a day,
right? Being with other Jews, et cetera, et cetera. And it's also a joyous experience. it turns out that when you bring Israelis not on a backpacking trip through the Andes or Thailand, but you bring them to a Jewish community for a period of time where they are surrounded by other Jews, where they learn, where they work, it has as much of a transformational effect on them as it has on Jewish kids from here. So one of the programs the Jewish Agency has been expanding significantly the last few years is a program for 18-year-olds in the year between graduating high school and starting the army. The army allows for a number of them to spend a year in community service, and most of them do it in Israel. So some of them during this gap year actually end up going to communities around the world. So in the United States and Canada and England and other places last year, we had about 70 of them all together. This is on top of probably about 1,100 to 1,200 summer camp counselors from Israel that we recruit and train and bring, and 250 other what are called shlichim or emissaries, including you know those that are right here in Tucson.
Right, of course.
I've interviewed many of them and talked to them both before and after, and the one phrase I've heard more often than any other is that we came here as Israelis, we're leaving here as Jews. Because for them, this is a discovery of pluralistic Jewish life, of the opportunity to practice Judaism in ways that Americans can, or the English, etc. Because for many of them, Judaism in Israel, on the one hand, it's something they live and breathe, you know, every seventh day is Shabbat, and, you know, Yerushalayim is Yerushalayim. I mean, I just came back from Israel this morning, actually, came straight from to Tucson, and this past week in Israel, between Yom HaShoah, the day of the Holocaust remembers, and today, which is Yom HaTzmaut, which is the it's like a new high holiday week.
Yeah.
In Israel, and
yeah, it's changed so much.
It's unbelievable how emotionally connected, etc., they are. But they don't connect it with the Jewish people
outside
and we actually don't connect it so much. I mean, although we think about it and we mark it on the calendar,
about it doesn't have anywhere near the same valence. Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's in some ways a danger of Jews in the diaspora, particularly in the United States, which is the second or maybe the first, nobody really knows, largest Jewish community in the world. 80% of all Jews live either in Israel or in the United States.
Right.
Growing apart and becoming almost two distinct
Jewish
peoples.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that the Jewish Agency began to work on. And so what we do in many ways is we bring Jews to Israel and we bring Israel to Jews in this attempt to actually reconnect Jews with each other, with their people, and with their heritage, and that pertains to Jews who are Israeli Jews and Jews who are Jews living in the diaspora.
I want to thank Misha Galperin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. If people want to find out more about the Jewish Agency, they can go to the website.
JewishAgency.org.
And there's all kinds of information. And fascinating to think that the real task of the Jewish Agency now is helping the Jewish people stay as one.
Indeed.
Thank you, and we wish you success. I know you only have a few more months in this position, but it's been a great ride, and we look forward to what comes next.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, Shalom, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Ari Shavit, journalist and author of the outstanding book, My Promised Land.
Our playout this morning comes from our house rock band, Avanim, performing Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha, great peace of they who love the Torah. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha. Shalom Rav. Shalom Rav Ve'eim Amo. Ve'eim Amo. Me a soul.